Hello and welcome to the Deathcast. I'm your host, author, and journalist Ian Totten. I'd like to thank you for joining me. Prepared to take our second look at the Order. Before we get going, as always, I have the normal show notes. If you'd like to follow me on social media, just search for the Deathcast. If you'd like to support the show, there's two ways you can do this. First, you can go to your favorite podcast app, leave a 5-star review, and follow the show. You can also go to tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon, where for as little as $1.99 a month, you can get access to early and ad-free shows, just as my first two Patreon members, Channel and Anthony, did. Again, that's tinyurl.com/dcastpatreon. All right, now that all of that is out of the way, find yourself a nice comfy chair, kick back, and relax. I've got my coffee, I've got my cigarettes. Let's go into the crypt! We left off last week. We had been talking about the first of two groups that played into the creation of the Order. That being the National Alliance. This week we are going to be looking at the other group that fed into the creation of the Order, the Aryan Nations, as well as the man who was responsible for the Order, Robert J. Matthews. The National Alliance was a national Nazi organization started in 1970 by Richard Gernt Butler, an engineer who was born in Bennett, Colorado on February 23rd, 1918, and ended up moving to Los Angeles, California with his family around 1931. Butler ends up going to Los Angeles City College, where he gets a degree in aeronautical engineering. Some sources state that during this point in time, he helped to invent the rapid repair tubeless tire. We know that prior to the start of World War II, Butler ends up getting involved with the Silver Legion of America, also known as the Silver Shirts, who are a pro-Nazi organization that had been founded by William Dudley Pelley in January of 1933. With the attack on Pearl Harbor, however, the federal government starts cracking down on various anti-American groups, the Silver Shirts being one of them. So we can already see that he is fomenting, you know, a racist ideology. He ends up getting married in 1941 to a woman who would be his spouse until her death in 1995. And with the attack on Pearl Harbor, he ends up enlisting in the Air Force, serving stateside for the duration of the war. For all viewpoints, it does not appear that Butler stood out during his time in the Air Force. He's going to have a fairly successful career as an engineer, working for various different companies, including Lockheed Martin. In his personal life, however, he is going to start identifying and becoming involved with the Christian Identity Movement. Although we don't have a specific point in time when Butler, who was a Protestant, begins to believe in this ideology, by the early 1960s, though, Butler is firmly entrenched in the Christian Identity Movement. We know this as he begins to make a series of groups which are very anti-communist, pro-white, veiled under the guise of religion. One of these is the California Committee to Combat Communism. The other is the Christian Defense League, which was founded in 1964, although some sources state that it was actually founded between 1957 and 1962. Butler's going to end up serving as the national director for the Christian Defense League from 62 to 65. They were rather infamous for sending out mailers that began with, "The NAACP represents the Negro, the ADL represents the Jews, who represents you, the white Christian." During this point in time, as he's serving as the executive director, that Butler joins something called the Church of Jesus Christ Christian, which is a white supremacist religious organization that was founded in 1946 by Wesley A. Swift in Lancaster, California, and unfortunately still exists to this day, although in a different form. In 1970, Swift ends up passing away. His wife and a few close confidants end up taking control of the church. However, Butler ends up in control of the church somehow, and upon assuming control, moves the headquarters of the church to Hayden Lake, Ohio. And it's while he's in Hayden Lake that Butler founds the Aryan Nations. Butler viewed the Aryan Nations as the vanguard, the military wing of the Church of Jesus Christ Christians. He preaches a message, obviously, of hate and of preserving the white race, but also of Nazism. The Aryan Nations very quickly starts to gain traction within the white supremacist world, and while not as prominent or impactful as the National Alliance that William Luther Pierce ended up founding, the Aryan Nations still is an influential group. Butler has a 20-acre compound in Idaho from which he conducts business. By the early 1980s, he ends up holding yearly revivals at the compound, inviting members from all over the country. It is interesting to note, however, that unlike Pierce's National Alliance, adherents to the Aryan Nations are linked to crimes committed throughout the decades, so much so that the Aryan Nations are going to end up the target of various lawsuits with victims of the crimes perpetrated by members, and will eventually lose control of both the compound as well as the copyrights and name associated with the Aryan Nations brand. But before all of that happens, the Aryan Nations is going to end up giving birth to an organization who end up going down in infamy within the white supremacist world for the crimes that they committed, and that is the Order, who are the main focus of this series. Now, the Order ends up being founded in the early 1980s by Robert J. Matthews, an individual, unlike many within the white supremacist movement, during the 1970s, early 1980s, who was only tangentially on the federal government's radar. So Robert J. Matthews was born on January 16th, 1953 in Marfa, Texas, which is located in the southwestern part of Texas. At the time of Matthews' birth, it was estimated that there was roughly 3,700 people living in the city. To get a better look at Robert J. Matthews, we need to look at his family. His father, Johnny, was born in 1950 in Atoka, Oklahoma. They eventually end up moving to Detroit, Michigan, as his father found work at the Ford Motor Company. In 1930, he ends up taking off to Arizona, where he finds work on a ranch near Red Rock. Although he eventually comes back to Detroit. After graduating high school, Johnny attends Southern Methodist University in Dallas, Texas, working for a paper company afterwards before heading back to Detroit. And it's during this return trip to Detroit that Johnny meets Una Grant. Johnny ends up being brought into the Air Force as an officer, and in 1943, he and Una are wed in Detroit. Una ends up going back to Detroit for a short spell in late 1944, early 1945, where she gives birth to the couple's first child, Grant Matthews. After Japan surrenders, Johnny Matthews is mustered out of the Air Force, where he returns to Detroit. And after a brief stay there, the family decides to return to Marfa. This is in 1947. And it seems that for a period of time, the Matthews family lived that idealistic American dream that is so often talked about, having been pervasive during the 50s and early 1960s following the war, that in reality was more of a creation of the government and the media than it was of the day-to-day life of the average American family. They buy a house. Johnny is able to open up an appliance store. He's elected the mayor of Marfa and also becomes the head of the Chamber of Commerce. They have a second son born in January of 1949 named Johnny Lee Matthews. And Johnny ends up upsetting locals by instituting a number of fairly simplistic tax maneuvers, such as getting a new factory brought in, which pulls many of the Mexican laborers from the ranches in the area into the factory where they can get better wages and not have to work so hard, and instituting things such as a price on garbage collection. This basically turns the Matthews families into a pariah within Marfa, which is unfortunate as the area was so well suited to them that Una's family, her mother and father, had actually moved down to Marfa prior to the family's third son, Robert Robbie J. Matthews, being born in January of 1953. With this turn of events, however, things with the Matthews clan in Marfa get rapidly worse when the business that Johnny has been building ends up going belly up. At which point, Johnny convinces his wife that, you know, he's been to Phoenix, Arizona before. He really thinks that it's a good place for them to try and start anew. And so the family ends up moving out to Phoenix. This is in 1957, where he again ends up working for the Graham Paper Company. As for young Robbie, it's been said that he was a fairly unremarkable child. He was well-behaved. As with his older brothers, he was involved in the Boy Scouts and just seemed to be your atypical all-American boy. However, as the 1960s roll on and civil unrest begins to appear all over the country, this facade is going to change for the worse. Now, if you know anything about American history, you know that from the mid to late 1940s onward, there was a very heavy anti-communist push underway within the country, both from the government with individuals such as Andrew McCarthy actually ruining people's lives by claiming they were associated with or were in fact communists, but also from the media as well as America's religious institutions. Americans were inundated with a constant stream of, communists are here to destabilize the American way of life and destroy the American family, and we as Americans have to stand together and root these individuals out wherever they may hide, yada yada yada. It was basically a witch hunt where anything went, and anyone who was labeled a communist had a very difficult time of either proving that they were not or of surviving financially once the accusations had been laid. So for those who think that, cancel culture is a new thing, no, it's not. It's been here for decades within the United States, perpetrated by both the left and right against those that they perceive as their enemies. During this point in time, however, the right is hellbent on painting anybody that they can as a communist, and unfortunately, as a result of this mentality of they're our enemy, they must be rooted out, they must be destroyed, creates something of a moral panic in the minds of many within the United States. And this moral panic is going to come home and roost within the Matthews home during the late 1950s, early 1960s. From all of the information that I've been able to gather, it does not appear that either of Robbie's parents were overly political or in any way religious. We do know that Mrs. Matthews, Una, liked to read to her children and encouraged them to read, often pointing out to them various pieces in the newspaper that she found of interest and that she believed her sons would find interesting as well. The first piece of the puzzle that makes up who Robert J. Matthews was comes in this form when Una is reading an article in the Phoenix newspaper about the John Birch Society, and mentions to Robbie that she thinks he should take a look at it. Now, John Birch was a United States Army Air Force intelligence officer tied into the OSS, which later became the CIA during World War II. He was stationed in China, who was killed by communist Chinese troops in Suzhou, China, on August 25th, 1945. In early December of 1958, a group of 12 men, headed by a retired candy manufacturer and conservative named Robert W. Welch Jr., converged in Indianapolis, Indiana, and created the John Birch Society in his name. Welch said that Birch was the first American casualty of World War III, while also claiming that communist sympathizers within the United States government had covered up Birch's death in China at the end of the war. Basically, Welch said that the goal of the John Birch Society was to have less government and more personal responsibility. They were extremely anti-communist, and very quickly, the John Birch Society takes a firm grasp of the mind of many conservatives throughout the United States. This isn't the kind of society that you think of when you think of a conservative organization, you know, where they have a lot of racial rhetoric thrown into the things that they're saying, so much so that many people try to disassociate themselves from that branch of the right-wing political spectrum to some degree. A lot of very prominent members of society started joining the John Birch Society. Not just politicians, but future politicians, businessmen, and by some accounts, even some presidents. One thing that set the John Birch Society apart from other organizations is that they were the first to start pushing conspiracy theories around, such as, you know, the idea that outside forces control our government. If we don't act now, we risk losing the American way of life, etc., etc. They are and continue to be an extremely influential group within the American right, specifically the far right. During the 1960s, the John Birch Society was still growing rapidly, with a number of different chapters opening up in and around the Phoenix area, with an estimated 2,000 by 1962. Now, the Matthews family knew nothing of the Birch Society at this point. During 1960, their oldest son, Grant, ends up being diagnosed with schizophrenia, and naturally, this ends up eating up a lot of Robbie's parents' time. So he and his older brother Lee are left to fend for themselves. And eventually, one Sunday morning in 1964, Una, who is reading the newspaper, comments offhandedly about how interesting a supplemental that has been placed into the weekly paper is, and this particular supplemental was extolling the virtues of the John Birch Society. Naturally, Robbie reads this, and while his parents did not believe it was a problem for their son to read about such an organization, when he comes to them a few days later and announces his intention to join the John Birch Society, both of them are floored. It's been said that Johnny was enraged that his son would think of joining such an organization, while it was his mother who cautioned against fighting this particular battle, believing that it was only a passing phase, that their son would look into it and soon move out of this phase of his adolescence. Robbie is allowed to join the John Birch Society as a junior member. Robbie ends up going on something of a health kick, weightlifting and joining the school's wrestling team, while his parents watch on perplexed, but also somewhat grateful that their son is choosing to pursue these interests, as all around them, there is a growing air of unease within the United States with the counterculture and the civil rights movement taking firm hold of the American public consciousness. We know that Robbie is eventually going to become a full-fledged member of the John Birch Society, We also know that he tries to get his parents interested in the viewpoints that the society puts out there, so much so that at least once he's able to convince them to go to a speaking engagement that Robert Walsh is giving in the Phoenix area, although they have no interest other than humoring their son beyond that. It's been said that Robbie ends up having numerous fights with his father over pretty much everything during this period of time, including leaving notes around the house telling his father that he needs to stop smoking, it's better for his health, etc., etc., and it gets to a point that Johnny lets his youngest son know and know on certain terms that he needs to knock that shit off. A number of older men within the Birch Society take Robbie under their wing, ensuring that he's able to make meetings and various other group functions while his family continues on through the 1960s. Eventually, the Matthews' oldest son, Grant, ends up being institutionalized, and around this time, the second oldest, Lee, is set to begin college. So his parents sell their home and move the four of them across the city to a three-bedroom apartment, which ensures that Lee will not have a long commute getting to school every day. While the move helps out Lee, it ends up introducing Robbie to something he, so far as we know, had no real involvement with prior to this, and that is religion. There is a fairly large Mormon population in and around Phoenix, Arizona, and upon entering a new high school, Robbie meets a good number of Mormon students who very quickly accept this young man who doesn't smoke or do drugs, but believes in a conservative lifestyle, keeps his hair cut short, and dresses as best as he possibly can. When Robbie expresses an interest in joining the Mormon Church to his parents, his father is once again opposed to this idea, while his mother takes a more middle-of-the-road approach, pushing her husband to allow Robbie to join the Mormon Church, believing that it might be good for him, especially given the turns that society has taken by this point. If you know anything about the 1960s, 1970s, there is a lot of left-wing political movement stuff happening, particularly with organizations such as the Black Panthers, the Weather Underground, groups that the federal government is going to label as domestic terrorists, and were little more than that. We see a lot of that today in this country, both on the left and the right. These, you know, organizations that are promoting violence and carrying out acts of violence to further their political ideology, well, morons on either side cheer them on enthusiastically. Una Matthews saw all of this and thought, you know, what can it hurt for my son to get involved with the Mormons? At least he's not going to be out, you know, joining a left-wing organization, doing drugs, and possibly bombing government institutions. Little did she know where all of this was going to lead her son. Because during this point in time, there were a lot of people within the Mormon Church in and around Phoenix who were of the extreme right-wing nature. And it's to these elements that Robbie is going to very quickly be drawn. These are the types that go on to form and or join militias. Again, something that in early 1970s America is unheard of and that no one really has any experience with. They're very similar in nature to groups like the Weather Underground. Although, whereas the Weather Underground, you know, went out and actively orchestrated a campaign of violence against the U.S. government, most of these organizations do not. That's not to say that some of them don't, but especially during this point in time, it's unheard of. So, Robbie ends up joining the Mormon Church, although his father lets him know in no uncertain terms that the minute he starts proselytizing, it's on between the two of them. Family goes with him the night that he is baptized. Robbie's parents very quickly saw a change in their son. He still had the same anti-communist, pro-American point of view that they had come to know and expect, but he was now starting to talk more and more about how the government was illegal and were doing things to the American people which violated the Constitution, talk which to his parents were the words of an extremist, which is really what Robbie was becoming, because inside the Mormon community, he had found the survivalists and those who did not believe the government should be allowed to do the things that it was doing, particularly the taxation of the American people. He felt drawn to the anti-tax movement, and upon learning that an individual within that movement, who was from Arizona by the name of Marvin L. Cooley, young Robbie, 17 years old, resolved to go hear the man speak when he appeared in Mesa, something that his mother put her foot down on, stating that he was not going to go see this man speak, nor was he to get involved in that movement. Robbie, however, is not to be dissuaded. After having an argument with his economics teacher, Robbie refuses to attend the class further, stating that all of the information they are being given is, in reality, communist indoctrination. Robbie ends up going to hear Cooley speak anyways, and eventually, because of how much he stands out, Cooley takes an interest of him, with Robbie acting as security but also as an aide during future speaking engagements. I'm going to take a brief sojourn here to point out that the way that Robbie ends up getting into all of this is exactly how most right-wing groups operate. The left may operate in a similar fashion with its more violence-prone groups, although I really don't know as I have not done a ton of research on them. I know that the right kind of targets young people, playing on their fears in order to get them interested, and then once they have their attention, they start feeding those fears with a healthy dose of hatred against various different organizations and or groups of people. And that's not to say that it's the intention of all of these organizations to take, you know, healthy semi-intelligent young men and turn them into violent extremists. But there are those within the extreme far right who operate knowingly under this mindset. William Luther Pierce is a perfect example of this. Hence the reason why he started a record label and had his minions go out and distribute racist music at concerts where teenagers and young men in their early 20s were likely to congregate. He viewed many of these people as being less than he was intellectually and therefore expendable, which is why he never went out and did any violent actions himself, instead filling these young impressionable minds with such hateful rhetoric that these young impressionable men felt they had no other choice but to act against these outside threats. It's something that we still see to this day. Targeting a group of people as being our enemies and building up fear of these individuals within the minds of those who are fearful by nature, always looking for someone else to blame, and not intelligent enough to critically think for themselves, to the point that they go out and commit acts of violence under the guise of protecting, you know, America's so-called sovereignty or the white man's right to exist and be in power. The reasons they give are fairly simple-minded and shallow and have no basis in reality, but to the young and impressionable youth who have no real world experience and who look to these people to guide them and to tell them the truth and help them grow into a productive member of their society. Really, they look at these people as surrogate parents. These people's words are all true. They take them to heart, and then you see these goons going out and shooting people or stabbing and beating people, etc., etc. Oftentimes, but not always, there is an element of mental illness at play in these individuals that has long gone unaddressed. And when they do act, they do go out and do something, those who these young men looked up to are able to raise their hands and say, hey, I never told them to do any of these things. I was simply talking. They realized that for themselves that the threat was real and decided to act against it before it's too late. Thus, hoping to absolve themselves of any responsibility, be it criminal or civil liability, while pointing out to their followers, see, this person, you know, had the balls to go out and stand up for our rights. You know, others should do this too. It's a vicious, disgusting, and disturbing cycle that is based upon a very basic and simple psychological ideal that if you take someone and inundate them completely with a certain message and then surround them with other individuals who think in the same way, eventually you will be able to control their thoughts, actions, and emotions with your words. In this case, these young men are being inundated with this ideology of, you know, the government is our enemy, communism is our enemy, they're everywhere, the government is in league with the communists, our way of life is being threatened, and also, by the way, Jesus Christ is going to return, which is going to begin the 1,000-year reign of Christ on earth. and only those who are his true believers are going to be saved when he returns. So we need to act now and protect ourselves and prepare for his coming. And the only way that we can do this is by opposing these enemies of not only of our nation, but also of our theology and our way of life. And that is exactly what Robbie is going through. He's being indoctrinated, first with the John Birch Society, then as he is moving within this society, he comes into contact with individuals within the Mormon community who are on the extreme fringes of that religion, and because so many of their ideologies line up with his, he takes up with those people and begins ingesting the things that they are telling him, holding them to be truth. So much so that he decides that he needs to not only, you know, let other people know this information, but he needs to act because he's smarter than so many of the others, and being smarter than so many of the others, he can be part of the elite vanguard that is going to protect the American way of life for everyone, especially those who don't even realize that their way of life is being threatened by these outside forces. Which leads us to 1971, which is going to be something of a turning point in Robbie's life. So now he's 18 years old. Robbie lets his parents know after the debacle involving the Keynesian theory being taught in the economics course that he will no longer be going to that class, no matter what the school says, and that he's not going to go to college as they are hotbeds of communism. Instead, Robbie starts to dream of going to West Point Academy, and while his father, who is also working as a recruiter for the Air Force, tries to push his son in that direction, he eventually relents and is able to get Robbie an appointment to take the entrance exam to West Point. While they are waiting for the date of the test to approach, however, something happens that seems to sour Robbie's intentions of joining the United States military, and that is on March 31st, 1971, Lieutenant William Calley ends up being convicted of murdering 22 Vietnamese civilians in the My Lai Massacre of 1968. Robbie views the conviction of Calley as having been a miscarriage of justice, and Calley as having only followed orders despite mountains of evidence to the contrary. He tells his father he's no longer interested in taking the exam. However, Johnny is not to be dissuaded and forces Robbie to take the exam, which he promptly fails. Now, whether or not this was done intentionally or not is long been a topic of debate among those who have studied the order and the white supremacist movements as a whole. The fact remains that Robbie cannot get into West Point, and any hopes his parents may have had of him pursuing a career in the military are dashed at this point. Instead, Robbie is unable to graduate from high school, and he begins taking a number of menial jobs in and around the Phoenix area once school finishes. Moving with his family into a trailer park in Tempe, Arizona, which is just outside of Phoenix, and continuing to work various odd jobs. What no one knew at this point in time, however, was that Robbie had moved well beyond the fringes of both the John Birch Society and the Mormon Church, and had actually started a paramilitary anti-tax group known as the Sons of Liberty. Not only did those within Robbie's family not know this, no one in and around Phoenix or in law enforcement ever heard of the group until the following June 1972, when a local television reporter by the name of Ted Knight received a phone call from a young unidentified male who told Knight of an organization operating in the Phoenix area that believed the United States was headed for imminent destruction at the hands of the communists. This unidentified male, who would later be identified as Robbie Matthews, told Knight that the group were preparing for guerrilla war and asked Knight, who was a very well-known conservative in the Phoenix media, if he would like to come and see one of their training exercises. As Knight would later tell authorities, he was directed to go to a payphone, and this led to a number of phone calls involving four different payphones over the course of 2 days. Eventually, Knight ends up in Paradise Valley, longtime home of deceased professional wrestler and WWF World Heavyweight Champion superstar Billy Graham. As I've said, everything always comes back to wrestling, where he is finally told how to go about making contact with this group. He is directed to a number of different roads and told to drive out there, park and flash his headlights 3 times, which Knight, with a cameraman in tow, does. After which he waits 5 minutes and flashes them 2 more. According to Knight, 10 minutes passed without any sort of activity, and then they heard the unmistakable sound of feet moving across the desert floor. Knight said that he was just able to make out a group of men marching in military formation wearing fatigues coming towards them at double time. As he would later state during the report he did on the group which came to be known as the Sons of Liberty, he noted that they were carrying weapons, wore bandoliers filled with ammunition and hand grenades, and that each man wore a camouflage mask over his face held down by an army helmet. Obviously, Knight is starting to get worried at what he is seeing, a militia operating in the United States just outside of his hometown of Phoenix, Arizona. Then someone comes up to the car and gets in the back seat. I have to imagine that Knight was thinking at this point that all of this was like a bad movie, possibly, you know, a political thriller with this paramilitary group and their secret phone calls reaching out to the media and directing him out into the middle of nowhere in the middle of the night. You know, the coded flashing of the headlights, etc., etc. But it was real. It was no movie. So now, after the man gets into the car, another individual who is leading the marching troops signals for the car to follow them. They arrive at a small camp set up with tents and lanterns, and Knight is astonished to see that the majority of the men gathered end up going on perimeter walks of the encampment, as well as doing basic military maneuvers. And while Knight interviewed one of the men, taping it onto a tape recorder, his cameraman films the movements of this militia. One individual speaks to Knight during the course of the interview, informing him that they are known as the Sons of Liberty. He goes on to explain that the organization is made up of many individuals, a good number of whom are, in fact, Army veterans who feel that the United States is heading towards a disaster, that everything is controlled by the communists and the government, and that they are prepared to wage a guerrilla war against the communists in an attempt to save the country, before going on to inform Knight that there is no way for him to know who any of them are. They could be policemen or politicians, the man working at the 7-Eleven near his house, only that there are many more of the Sons of Liberty than those present on this night, and that everyone should be prepared for when they make their first move. To me, this is just some dumb fuckery on this organization's part in an attempt to sow fear in the minds of the community and law enforcement. And to paraphrase Ole Anderson, so many other dumb fucks have come along since these dumb fucks were in operation that the original dumb fucks, the Sons of Liberty, have moved up to being not as dumb as subsequent groups. And I say that because if you were planning something like this, you're going to do something like this, why would you announce it to the media unless you are hoping to, you know, bring fear to the citizenry? I think it's twofold. They wanted to sow fear, but they also were hoping to get recruits from this broadcasting via public airwaves that they, in fact, exist. It's almost certain that Robbie Matthew and his co-conspirators in the Sons of Liberty had gotten this idea from the Minutemen, the first known right-wing militia active in the United States during the 1960s. In any event, the Sons of Liberty end up giving Knight some literature that they have written. He then heads back to Cool News, that's K-O-O-L, News. The next day, when he arrives at work, he is greeted in the news editor's office by both members of the FBI and the Secret Service, who ask that the station not air any of the footage they have taken of the Sons of Liberty. Knight would later say that initially he was unsure of how the men learned that he had been there until one of the agents smiled at him and he realized that there had been an informant, probably this agent, with the Sons of Liberty. According to Knight, one of the members of law enforcement then stated, quote, "These people aren't a big group and you can't take them seriously. We would prefer the people of Phoenix not see your story until we can identify just who they are." And I know some people might be thinking, you know, why would the agencies of federal government ask a media organization who supposedly has freedom of the press not to run a story? This is actually something that is extremely common within the media and has been for decades, going back to at least the pre-code days of Hollywood and continuing up until the present day. Most media organizations, whether they be a movie studio or a news organization, have some form of liaison from the various organs of the federal government who will outright direct them to, say, make a very patriotic, pro-American war movie, to not run a particular news story, to not make movies which are anti-America or anti-government in nature, that type of thing. And And you may be thinking, this is just some crackpot conspiracy theory type shit, but the reality is that there is documentation as well as interviews with individuals who worked in this capacity out there for public consumption where they lay the entire thing out for you. So, no, it's not a conspiracy theory by any stretch of the imagination. And that is what is going on here in Phoenix. However, Cool, which was a CBS affiliate, reaches out to CBS in New York, who tells them that they should, in fact, run the story. The day after the news story ran, the FBI ends up subpoenaing everything that Knight and his cameramen have in relation to the Sons of Liberty. Knight would later state that he feared at this point for his life, thinking that the Sons of Liberty would feel that he betrayed them if they learned that the FBI was now involved in trying to discover their identities. That is until late August, early September of 1972, when a letter arrives at the offices of Cool, addressed to Knight, wherein an anti-tax brochure published by the Sons of Liberty was discovered, with a note on it saying, quote, "Thanks for a job well done." Knight would state that he heard nothing more about the Sons of Liberty until a phone call arrived in November of 72. It was the same voice that had initially reached out to him, asking if Cool wanted to cover the Sons of Liberty as they raided Cuba. Something that the newsroom was unwilling to participate in, and which no doubt found its way into the FBI files not long after the phone call had been placed. We are going to end the episode at this point with Robbie Matthews, unbeknownst to anyone in his immediate family or the society at large, having founded his first extremist group and the FBI taking an interest in said group. I hope that you guys have enjoyed this episode, and until next time, stay morbid.